This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. Welcome to the fourth episode of In the Elfless Time. I'm Marita Kelly. In this episode, I sketch the developments in dairy equipment and winter fodder, along with looking at the recent fodder crisis and farming from a younger perspective. Rural electrification, the process of bringing electrical power to rural and remote areas, brought farming into a new era. Electricity is not only used for lighting and household purposes, but it also allows for mechanisation of farming operations such as milking. In areas facing labour shortages, this also allows for greater productivity at a reduced cost. I pay a visit to Robert Collins's farm to hear his early memories of dairy equipment and seeing a Lister engine driving the pump.
The Lister engine. The Lister engine was used by my father before electricity was for milking the cows. It was something from the early 1950s when they got their first bucket plant, which is a lot different now from a herringbone or anything that you'll see today. The engine was to drive it. It drove a pump, and that's what built the cows. In the 1950s, why did he get a milking machine? We was often ask him, why were you getting a milking machine in the early 1950s? He said, first thing, it made it easier to milk the cows, and you could milk that few more cows, even though people, I suppose, didn't, in a lot of cases, didn't milk an awful lot more cows, but still it was easier to milk 14 or 15 or maybe 20 cows, even with a bucket plant, two or three bucket plant, and then to have two or three fellas in hand milking. You know, that was a hard job, a thing I did very little of, and I never liked any time I ever had to do it. The engine, yeah, I see the engine, but the engine was never working, but my father often spoke about it. But he said it was kind of temperamental as well at times. When we were milking the cows, he could stop, and all the machines fall off the cows, and you have to go out around to the back, around to the back of another back house, and then get your handle out and go fiddling with plugs and swinging handles, you know, can you get it going? It was good. And one of the reasons here he got it, I suppose, other than being milk cows faster, is they found it harder to get someone to milk cows of a Sunday and a Sunday evening. You had people working for you then, but that was coming into the 1950s and people were starting to go to England working, and like, who wants to be working 7 days a week? Even in the 1950s, I presume people could see that it was hard going to have to be there every morning and every evening. But it was good. I remember the milking machine going, but it was an electric motor was running it before the milking problem. And I milked cows with it too. It's all right. It was slow.
Once upon a time, Mocker and a farmer cycled from farm to farm, encouraging people to convert to electricity.
I was talking to some of my neighbours, and when they were in Mocker first, and they said, they went around and they were trying to convince people. It was hard enough actually to convince people about getting electricity into their house. They said in some cases, yes, people can be hard to change people's attitudes to things. But, I've been telling the stories. There was one woman supposed to have got in the electricity, and they came around and she was putting very little usage up in the meter. And they asked her, oh, how was she doing? How come she wasn't used? And she said she only turned on the light while she was looking for the candle. So whether there was any truth in that, I'm not too sure. Yeah.
Along with movements in our dairy equipment, cattle diets have also been transformed, with the focus on nutritional feed value making a considerable difference. I'm at Moorpark from Moy with Tagus Regional Manager Gerard McMahon to sketch the developments in winter fodder.
The major drudgery has gone out of feeding cattle over the winter. In the 50s, hay, fodder beet, mangels, turnips formed the base of the winter diet, often supplemented with home-grown barley, oats, and the protein source was meat and bone meal, which wouldn't be allowed anymore. Most of the feeding and delivered stock was done manually. And I remember when we started farming in the early 60s, we had fodder beet. And the fodder beet had to be pulled manually. It had to be snagged and cleaned and pulped and fed to cows. So all that sort of level is gone. And cows generally at that time were in stalls. So you had manual feeding. You had a head feed in front that you gave in the silage, the hay with a fork, and you wheelbarrowed in beet and the mangels. That was the big change. And 15, 20 or 30 cows was a lot on farms. 20 cows, 30, 40 was exceptional.
Diets can now be formulated for cows to do higher milk yields.
Now the main feed is pit silage. That used to be self-fed. Now that's put in front of the cows with a shear grab or a tine grab. And silage alone is a satisfactory diet for dry cows. They don't need any else with it. If the silage is very good, you may have to restrict the silage. Or if you have a diet feeder, you feed straw with it. Diet feeders give the advantage, when they came in first, fellas generally fed higher quality rations with them, so they got better production.
Outside of usual winter fodder supplies, there is now a recommendation that every intensive dairy farmer should have a backup of 2 high quality bales per cow for feeding in wet weather or where grass is poor. This means you have high quality grass available at all times. Earlier on, we heard the beginning of the advances in milking equipment. I'm in Machina Farm headquarters with Derry Dillon, Agriculture and Rural Affairs Manager, to trace the activity of milking machinery. I suppose dairying then has changed dramatically in Ireland. Dairy, we've gone from really milking by hand into a bucket or a bucket plant up to robotic units now.
Yeah, definitely, Marita, and it's all driven, I suppose, by higher numbers of cows on farms. Time is precious, and farmers have embraced new technologies as we've gone along. As you rightly say, we started off with milking by hand, then bits of bucket plants, then moving on to sort of parlours and 6 units, 4 units, 8 units, 12 units, gone up to maybe 30, 32 units now at this stage. We've new other ideas like automatic cluster removers, and it's all about how many cows you can milk in an hour and how many cows you can put through the parlour. And then if you want to go to the other extreme, you can go to a robotic milker, and where you might have 1 or 2 robots on the farm, and the cows will come in voluntary, and the robot will milk them, and will clean their udders, will give you analysis on every one of their teats and what inside them and the composition of the milk and the quality of the milk. And certainly it has taken away a certain amount of the need for labour in the parlour, but the robots are still a limited amount of them around the country. They're growing in popularity, but they're for certain types of systems and they don't suit all farmers. So still a lot of farmers milking cows in parlours, and we'll continue that way. And I suppose the one thing about the robot is you won't get kicked by the cow, but you will still in the parlour.
And it's handy on a Sunday morning.
It's handy on a Sunday morning, but then you have farmers doing 13 milkings in the week, so they might skip a Sunday evening or a Sunday morning that way. So
is there a bit of a turn towards once a day milking?
Some people have tried it. High output cows certainly won't suit. It's a particular type of cow and a particular type of farm setup that suits once a day milking, but it's not that popular.
And you were saying that the robotic unit doesn't really suit everyone. What kind of a unit or a setup would it suit?
It suits indoor systems at the moment, where cows are kept mainly indoors for most of the year. Chagas have done some developments in terms of outdoor and grass-based systems, where you can have the cow coming through, sort of the middle of the farmyard, through the robot, onto the next pasture. So the farm has to be well laid out to suit the robot, because the only motivator for the cow to come into the robot is nice fresh grass on the other side. She might also get a bit meal or something like that as a treat to coax her in, but it's all about moving her on to new fresh pastures. So the farm has to be well laid out, that the robot is sort of in the centre of the farm, and that the yard is based in the centre, and that the cow can move freely to the next paddock for fresher grass.
So it's nearly like a greenfield site farm then that this would suit?
In some cases, unless the farm can be easily converted and the farm is well positioned in terms of the overall land area. So it's our but basically at the moment it suits indoor systems, where people might be doing zero grazing. They might be cutting the grass, bringing grass into the cows, and the cows are generally based in around the yard. That suits a robotic system.
Derry To handle milking on large dairy herds, rotary milking parlours are considered an effective use of time, labour and space. With our national goal to expand our dairy herd, I've come to Tom Bram's farm in Cork to see firsthand the benefits of modern technology. So Tom, just tell me about the rotary parlour. How has it changed your life?
I suppose the main reason why we built the rotary parlour was because we wanted to get an easy and a fast way to milk cows and to get the throughput. We couldn't get it out of any other type of parlour, so that's why we decided to go for a rotary parlour.
And what way used to milk the cows before you had the rotary parlour?
In a herringbone, 22 unit herringbone parlour. And it used to take 2 hours to milk 300 cows. Now we can milk 800 cows in 3 hours.
How many can you put on at a time?
60 cows at a time.
And how has technology really changed agriculture, do you think?
Well, it has gone from where one man used to milk, say, 50 cows, to one man can now milk 800 cows. So, and it has changed the whole scene as regards keeping records and everything. With the modern milking parlours, they're all computerised, so you know exactly what's happening. You know what cows yield per day and you know what feed they're getting. They come into a collecting yard and they come on one by one and they leave, they back off. Like, they get used to it very fast.
And does it monitor each cow then as it milks?
It monitors and measures how much milk each cow has. So if the cow isn't milked, when she comes around, there's a retention bar to hold her in, so she goes back around and is milked the second time. The cluster is taken off automatically. She's automatically teat spread and automatically fed. She's fed automatically. When she comes in, the reader board picks up her number. Her number will be recorded and that will automatically give her the amount of feed she requires.
Would you recommend the rotary parlour now to anyone?
Not to everybody. You'd need to be milking over 300 cows to justify the cost. Well, you definitely want to be milking 250, even after that. I'd say be looking at it, but definitely anything less than 250 cows are too expensive. From 250 up, you'd want to be looking at it. Well, the only thing that can add to that is, I suppose, if you were hobby farming and you had a small herd of cows, you'd have a robot, and it's ideal for that, but I don't think robots have any place in big numbers, because you have to have too many of them, and that takes too much time.
How many does the actual robot cater for?
Each one would milk on about 60 to 70 cows. 60, I think, would be nearly the maximum.
But they come in then of their own accord?
They come in of their own accord. I don't think it's practical when you're grazing to use them. Now, they can do it, and then there are ways, but like, it's not that simple. Ideal if they're inside all the time.
Yeah, you'd want to be zero grazing then to have those ones.
Yeah, exactly.
Irish agricultural systems and weather have always been linked. Climatic change has resulted in winters getting longer and rainfall increasing, making life much more difficult for Irish farmers, as Gerard McMahon explains.
The first thing that weather does to farmers, if it's bad, puts them in bad form. It's the farm, the labour and the finances are the three things with it. And waiting around. Now, the other people that you don't think of is a contractor. A contractor has staff. And if he's cutting silage when the weather is good, he has much less downtime. We have our competitive advantage by our long grazing season and grass being the cheapest feed. But we've taken our eye off that ball a bit the last number of years. We were concentrated on budging it and measuring it rather than on growing it.
We're more bothered about quadrants.
Yeah, yes. And we forgot. And the simple thing is, some advisors up the country, when the farmer cuts his silage, he looks at his piece at the end. He should be looking at the individual fields and measuring them, trial plots of them, seeing the difference in yield and identify what's wrong in those fields and addressing the issues on them. 2012 was a very bad tail end of the year, and in the wetland there, farmers had to put stock in early. Fodder yields were bad. Fodder supplies were under pressure. We realised this in Tagus, and the people we were dealing with in discussion groups, we got them to ration out their feed, to feed meal and to feed straw and keep the silage for the dairy, the milking cows. And that worked reasonably well.
Farmers suffered immensely from food shortages for the livestock following the unseasonal winter weather.
people fed animals in some farms for 9 or 10 months. They had supplementary feeding. It put huge financial pressure on the people. Now, as early as January 2012, we in Tagus realised there was a problem, that I didn't think there'd be enough feed to go around. Farmers were under severe emotional stress, not to mind the financial stress, hearing animals bawling and not knowing where to get the food for them. It was the worst crisis that we had in farming in my time that I was around, the psychological pressure that was under. Tagus had an internal fodder crisis committee, and we saw then that it needed to be dealt with on a more national level, and within a week we had the National Fodder Crisis Agency was set up, and we had all representatives from the ICAS, the co-ops, the farming organisations and the Department of Agriculture and the vets. Dairy Gold started off then, and they imported feed from England, hay. Hay was the most vital thing to import, because when you have hay, the problem was that people couldn't feed a ruminant animal properly unless you had long fibre. So Dairy Gold led the way on that, the source feed in England. It was something that was outside the scope of the individual farmer. He didn't have the logistics or the finances or the context to source feed on that scale that was needed.
Dairy Gold brought in at least 300 loads of hay, which eased the situation.
They led the way, and that gave fierce peer to mind, and that allowed us to get through the fodder crisis without compromising the productive capacity of the dairy herd.
The fodder crisis that followed the wettest winter in decades reaped a bitter harvest among farmers, with a significant rise in suicides across the country. Studies reveal that some farmers who found themselves under intolerable pressure last winter and spring have found it impossible to emerge from the depression that engulfed them during the crisis.
Rural life can be quite a lonely one, and the fodder crisis certainly left a lasting effect. Rural youth organisation Machrana Fhearma has started a positive mental health promotion. I'm with their president, Kieran O'Dowd.
We've got a Rural Youth Initiative Committee, which has got people that sit on the National Council of the organisation, and we also have got people co-opted from around the country who want to sit on it. We have about 18 people on the committee at the moment. One of the priorities that does feature on that quite strongly is the whole area of positive mental health, because the majority of people affected by suicide and mental health issues are the young people between the ages of 17 to 35. And a few of our members have died by suicide in recent years, and I'm sure if you were to go back over time, a lot of them would have been affected by it, and that affects rural communities and rural families. So what we do is we try and work in partnership with charities like Console, like Aware. At the moment we're working with Sea Change, because we do the Green Ribbon campaign. We have it at our AGM in May, and we give every delegate to the AGM a green ribbon, and also some are sent around the country for clubs to sell and to promote Sea Change. And we also encourage members to get involved in HSE programmes like Assist. And I know in Laois they ran one very successfully recently, and other counties around the country will look at it as well and see what suits them, because it's not an easy issue, and there's a lot of lip service paid to the whole issue of positive mental health. But we would believe in Machrana that we, being Machrana Fhearma, are a good antidote for positive mental health, well, for negative mental health, and that we promote it by getting people out and about, getting them interacting with other people, helping them learn new skills. The great thing about Machrana is we're very much like a family organisation. From the first meeting you go to, someone will take you under their wing, they'll talk to you in a non-threatening environment. There's no agenda. They want you to enjoy your experience in Machrana. They want you to go along and develop and do what you want. Like, I've 10 years in Machrana. When I joined back in Sligo back in 2004, I, for a couple of years, was not taking up any officer position. I was happy to just be a member, go around to all the events, meet new people, because I had moved from Dublin back to Sligo, and it was quite lonely because a lot of my peers and friends, some were gone off travelling, some were gone off working different places, and you know, you're just wondering, what do you do? And to get a social outlet, other than it always having to revolve about drink and the pub and going watching the matches down there, it meant you could do something completely different. And it wasn't cash intensive either. So people that are struggling and under pressure financially,
it's not another pressure for them. Like, as I said, the entry fee is quite modest to become a member of the organisation, and then the events we run, we try and keep the prices low as well, so that we deliver maximum value for money, and that people get an opportunity, no matter how much money or little they have, to engage and go along, and that they don't feel embarrassed, that they don't feel, I can't go to that event because it'll cost X number of euros, or I'm going to have to spend a fortune on fancy clothes or whatever. Now, we do have our Easter balls, various other events around the place, but then there's also an afters opportunity as well for people to come along after the dinner to go along to the event on the night. And we just think by promoting those events, by helping local communities out, we do a lot to promote positive mental health by being the organisation we are.
There's a change in the attitude among the younger generation regarding travelling or gaining experiences abroad. Willie Houlihan studied for 5 years in Harper Adams in the UK before returning home to farm the land. He tells us why he decided to venture across the water.
The agricultural courses in Ireland weren't very appealing to me, and this seems the best way to go to UCD in Dublin, where it's all science based, or the likes of Kildare and Clonakilty, where it was very practical based, where this was a happy medium.
And how did you find it then when you came home to actually farm the land at home in Ireland?
I found it very good out there because the lectures were very practical and basic, and everyone was out on the field and out on farms, or looking at different enterprises and see how they work, and then your assignments were to see to do up an enterprise and how would you make it work and do visibility reports on it, and a lot of the stuff then was dealt through banks. A lot of our assignments there were done by being interviewed by people from the banks to see would they give us loan for the proposals that we sent out from.
What did you learn over there that you could implement when you came home?
Well, over there at the time, now they were very much on kind of seeing what environmental measures could be done within farming, whereas over here it was a case of you go on and you spray the crop, but they didn't look at what could be done, a way to save money, let's say, like with the ideas of an integrated farm management approach, where we look at a holistic point of view instead of just focusing on one thing and spending 100 euro on a can of spray, whereas over there they'd look at the whole view of it there and see, like, well, what could be done naturally, a kind of an organic method mixed in with the conventional agriculture, and to try and marry the two of them, which would give you both a low input but a high output.
What we're all looking for in farming. Do you think the people are more open-minded about going abroad to learn more about agriculture?
Yeah, more definitely they are, because the likes of Chagas now, they run trips there to New Zealand, and a lot of the machinery dealerships run trips to, let's say, the Deitz Fair or the Class factories there to see what's done, and people like going and like seeing what's happening. And I suppose more so to dairy boys, there seems to be kind of trying to take a lot out of the New Zealand system and implement it at home in Ireland. So people are open-minded, they like seeing what's happening, and plus the old Irish nature show, we're nosy old buggers, so we like to see what's happening.
Back at Machrana Firma headquarters with Derry Dillon, we look to the future.
What are young farmers looking at these days?
Lots of things. Young farmers are always on the lookout, certainly. A lot are looking to dairying at the moment as sort of new opportunities now that the quota system is going in 2015. So some are looking at their existing enterprises and are wondering, is dairying a better option for them? It won't suit everyone, dairying. Certainly beef farming, tillage farming has certainly a very strong role into the future. But at the moment, that's something that's exercising a lot of minds of young farmers, if they have the land area and if they have the wherewithal to go into dairying. They're looking at it, certainly, because the shackles are off. Quota was the limiting factor before. Now quotas are going in, as I say, 2015, and a lot more will be looking at the option. Whether they'll pursue it or not is another question. But
will the price not drop then?
There's always that fear, and the price will certainly drop into the future. We'll see more volatility in prices. We'll have good years and we'll have bad years. That's as inevitable as death. That's what it is at this stage. But once people are aware of that, and that systems are set up that way, and that you I suppose put some contingency away for them kind of difficult years. But certainly there's a growing demand continuously for milk globally. Other countries will increase if we don't increase increase. I suppose New Zealand is the classic example. It had the same quota as Ireland has had in 1984 when quotas came in. Now they're at, is it two or three times our scale of production, and Ireland has a target of 50% output under the food harvest by 2020. So we need young farmers to drive that growth and ambition, certainly, if we're going to achieve it.
You're not going to knock out the smaller fillers.
No, there's still a place for small-scale farmers, there's no doubt about it. They become more specialised, more niche-orientated, certainly. Some of them might be organic. Some of them might actually contract rare heifers for dairy farmers. So there's a growth in that sort of an area where dairy farmers aren't able to keep their replacement stock on farm because they haven't enough acreage they need it for the dairy cows to graze. So they're going to contract rear to specialist rearers who may be of smaller farms, they may be more fragmented, and certainly they look after the heifers for them in some cases, and they'll make a livelihood out of it.
It is quite clear that a serious progression in dairy equipment and winter fodder has been made, with a substantial influence from other countries and a stronger focus now on productivity. Join me in episode 5 when I look at wildlife, which sometimes comes into conflict with commercial farming. In the Alpha's Time was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. Presented and produced by Marita Kelly and edited by Sean Healy. A Community Radio Yall production.